This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to WTF with Mark Maron. I'm your host, Mark Maron. Welcome to Life's Banquet, a show about the highs and lows of all things edible, spreadable. And Nicole?
Pourable?
Yeah! Sick. With your hosts, Nicole Bailey and Zara Tangora. We're done. That's it. That's all we have for today. Hello. How are you?
Good.
What's going on?
You know, just got off of work.
Oh, yeah?
I did a tasting, so.
What were you tasting?
Beer.
Cock sandwiches?
No, we don't sell those at my workplace. Weirdly.
Interesting. What kind of beer did you have?
Well, I had like 300,000 different kinds of beer. There was cider, there were sour beers, there were IPAs, there were...
Sorry, my mom's texting me.
There's literally like a beer that's mixed with rosé and they sell it in a can. It's like not...
Whoa.
Why? Why does that exist?
I don't know. I miss the days when things were simple and we drank Zima and clear Pepsi and clear gasoline.
Yes.
As we discussed last week. Have you eaten anything delicious this week? You were telling me about some crunchy, crispy tofu.
Oh, yeah. I made some tofu, broccoli, cauliflower, roasted it all up with some cauliflower rice. Because, you know, checking out that low-carb scene.
Yeah, sexy. Keep it. Please keep it sexy.
Yeah.
Delicious. I had to cook. I shouldn't say had to. I chose to cook. I, on my own will, chose to cook for my mother, my stepfather, and their two friends because they were celebrating a joint anniversary.
Do I know the friends?
The Feldmans, Barbara and Ron Feldman. They're wonderful. I don't think you've met them.
No, I don't think I have. Okay.
They're so cute. They love to dance together. This is a fucking bullshit episode.
Sorry.
It's fine.
Jesus, we suck.
Oh, you know what? Mercury, huh? I don't know where it is, but it's fucking with me.
It is a planet.
What's the deal with Mercury? Okay, so anyway, I cooked for the Feldmans and my parents. They were both celebrating their anniversary. My parents are at 19 years. The Feldmans are at 30 years.
Jeez.
They're such lovely people. It was really, really fun, but they all have a different food allergy. So my mom, because she has colitis, can't do any raw veggies. She's not a picky eater at all, but she doesn't do raw veggies anymore. Rob, my stepdad, doesn't do gluten, dairy, and he doesn't like squash and other things that are now available in, you know, abundance at our local farmer's market.
Yes.
Where I like to shop. And the Barbara Feldman, severely allergic to garlic, and her husband, Ron, is avoiding all nightshades.
What?
It was very hard for me to make a dinner, but I did it.
Is she all alliums or just garlic?
Just garlic.
Weird. Okay.
Yeah. I think I have a sensitivity to garlic as well.
Hmm.
Because last night when I ate at the restaurant you were working at, it was delicious, but there was a lot of raw garlic in that Caesar. Mm. And I immediately became pregnant-sized with gas.
Oh, that's not... Okay, that was confusing. The way you phrase it.
I'm allergic to it. By allergic, I mean I get pregnant when I eat it.
So it's not a problem, though. It's easily fixed.
Isn't that a terrible allergy? Oh, my God. When I have apples, I get pregnant.
That's confusing.
It is confusing. But yeah, and then I guess other food things, what else did I make this? Oh, so what I ended up cooking for them was a roast chicken.
Okay.
Over some mushrooms and shallots. I made a salad that my mom just avoided with a delicious goat cheese and tahini dressing.
Yum.
That I whizzed up together. I was inspired by somewhere we're going later, Ops. You know how they always do that like, creamy like ricotta dressing?
Yeah, totally.
It's so delicious. There's a lot of shit happening in here.
Someone should silence their cell phones before they go on the air.
But anyway, so I made that stuff. I made a big salad with goat cheese and tahini dressing. I made some squash that was baked in like tomato and fennel sauce, which Ron avoided. Actually, he tried some and then he went into anaphylactic shock afterwards.
He just doesn't like it. He's not allergic. He got pregnant.
He also is pregnant. We're starting a family band.
Very cool.
Yeah. So today we're going to get right into it because we have a little bit of a shorter show because I don't want to say which one of us was late, but it was me.
There's no way to find out for sure.
So we're going to do part two of our three-part series on the 1990s.
Yeah.
And today, what are we going to talk about?
So basically, as I mentioned before, there's just too much stuff happening in the 90s. So what I decided to do is just kind of pull out, I guess, like vignettes of like stuff that was happening in the restaurant scene in New York that I thought was interesting to talk about, honestly. So it's just like...
Yeah, please. Like, I want... We were talking about this. We spent a long time together last week after the show, yeah. Bar crawling, smoking cigs. Just mm-hmm. kidding, Mom. Smoking cigs, drinking, kind of doing the thing that we like to do when we get together, sitting yeah. outside and talking shit.
Totally.
And you were telling me about some of this stuff, and it was so interesting. I actually think there should be some type of biopic.
Yeah, there's a lot. And there's actually, like, it's not all in one place. I had to do a bunch of research. So I'm also, like, going to be quoting a lot of stuff.
Are you going to do accents?
No, I can't do any accents at all. but I just want to quickly, before I dive in here, just set the scene for you, because we didn't really do that last week. So Clinton was president almost the entirety of the 90s, so just get your head in that Clinton administration vibe.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp and Kate Moss were together. By the way, he was 31 and she was 20 when they met, but I know, whatever.
Not surprising.
Gwyneth Paltrow and Brad Pitt were together.
Ooh.
And Gwyneth Paltrow and Winona Ryder were still friends.
Wait, why aren't they friends now?
I don't know, they had a falling out. No one's ever spoken
about
it.
Do you think it's about B. Pitt?
No.
Huh.
We don't know for sure.
Okay, call us, please.
The films that were in the theaters, in no particular order, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, starring Kevin Costner.
Ooh, call us.
I love that movie, even though he goes in and out of an English accent intermittently throughout the entire movie. Or it kind of just, like, fades away.
He just forgets.
Yeah. The Titanic movie was out there.
Never heard of it.
Jurassic Park, one of the greatest movies ever made.
Dinos.
Goodfellas.
Scary. Oh, sorry, that was Jurassic Park.
Yeah. And Kids was out. Chloe Sevigny was kind of becoming an it girl, that whole scene. You could still smoke in restaurants.
Yes.
Yeah.
Pizza Hut.
And I have here, this is kind of dark, but Michael Alec, Club Kid, was murdering his drug dealer / friend, Angel.
Yeah. Party monster.
Yeah.
Welcome to my UFO.
Yeah.
I love it. Thank you for putting us right there.
I feel like we're there.
Yeah, right? I feel like I'm eating Cheeto paws as we speak.
Okay, so now we're just going to flash backwards to 1991.
Okay.
And we are at the Mesa Grill, where Bobby Flay is the executive chef.
Sorry, Bobby Flay. And funny for some reason.
I know, it is funny.
He's grilling and chilling. Okay.
We don't really know why it's funny. And so I'm going to quote the New York Times because it's so funny. It's kind of long, but they said, "It's a sign of the times that an elegant and moderately expensive restaurant called Sophie went under last year, while its replacement, an obstreperous..." I forgot to look up how to pronounce that word.
I think it's obstreperous.
Great. "An obstreperous southwestern spot called Mesa Grill that turns out entrees under $20 is booming." And they go on to describe the food there as sassy Tex-Mex fare. And then this is how they described the inside of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. So it's a sizzling social scene characterized by loose-fitting Italian suits, ubiquitous ponytails, and more exposed legs than Churchill Downs.
What's Churchill Downs?
It's a horse race.
Oh!
Yeah.
Why are people having so much leg at the horse race?
I just assumed it was the horse's legs. I don't know.
Horse's legs are always exposed. Okay.
And I just want to mention some of the items that were on the menu there. Ahi tuna, as we mentioned last week.
People love it.
Mango salsa, which we didn't talk about. And there's also a pineapple salsa, like fruit salsas, we're obviously having fruit a salsas. Moment. And blue corn crusted salmon cakes. So, that's what was happening. Bobby Flay's first big deal job at the Mesa Grill. Okay, so now we're going to move on to 1993.
Okay.
When Ruth Reichel started working at the New York Times as a food critic. Sweet Baby Angel. I basically just wanted to read some of the stuff that she says. So, like, she reviewed, one of her first reviews was of Le Cirque, which obviously did not open in the 90s. Mm-hmm. But she talked so much shit about the service there, and she described her meal there as a parade of brown food, which I found was hilarious.
What a bitch.
And then this is just another quote from her, because I just think that she's an amazing writer. This is from, I'm pretty sure, 1995. She's reviewing just like a small Chinese restaurant. or Shanghai.
P.F. Chang's.
Yeah. But she's describing soup dumplings, and she says, "They look innocent, small, pale dumplings sitting quietly in the steamer. But they explode upon contact with the teeth, turning into flavor grenades that fill the mouth with intensely hot soup." Isn't that amazing?
Yes. And so accurate.
I also have to say, just digging back through the old archives of the New York Times and reading her food reviews of restaurants in the 90s is the most fun, and everyone should check that out.
I actually have a couple quotes from her in my story as well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I also call, I order soup dumplings when I go to Noodle Village. I just ask for the flavor grenades.
Yeah.
So now I feel better about it.
Flavor grenades. Okay, so now we're going to fast way forward, and, you know, we got to keep this shorter. But so essentially, we're now at 1997, when Balthazar opened. Oh. And this is an article from Vanity Fair describing the restaurant scene in the 90s, where Balthazar was like, where rich people hang out in the 90s. Is basically it.
Was Balthazar, no, not Keith McNally's first.
No. His first is...
The Odeon?
Maybe the Odeon is the first one. That was in 1980. So, like,
okay.
It's hard. Actually, there is no, like, I just assumed I would be like Keith McNally and there would just be a list of every restaurant that he opened and the year that it opened. Right. But, like, his Wikipedia page is like three sentences long.
Yeah.
And there's no such thing.
Totally. Oh, actually, you know, I meant Keith Hernandez. Little Mets trivia. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we are. We're about the Tsar, 1987. This is the list of people that were there. Calvin Klein, Spike Lee, Robert De Niro, Jerry Seinfeld, Steve Martin, Isaac Mizrahi. Remember that guy?
Oh, yeah, of course. Throwback. Informer.
On this night, despite the fact that the stock market dropped an astonishing 550 points during the day, it was business as usual. Young Wall Streeters sit in happy packs while older foursomes feast on the $98 three-tier seafood sampler as high as a wedding cake. So that's what it was like at Balthazar in 1997.
That's really funny. I had an ex-boyfriend, I'd say one boyfriend removed from now, which I don't have a boyfriend now. So let's just say a couple years ago, dating somebody. And I'm pretty sure he was cheating on me with his boss. Mm-hmm. And they went to Balthazar and they stayed until like 4 a.m. I remember it was a big thing. And he's like, oh, she wanted to get the seafood tower with me. And so they got the seafood tower. He, like, has the nerve to tell me about it. But then, check this, he got food poisoning from it.
Oh, my God.
And he shit his brains out for, like, a week. And I was like, that is karma in full effect.
Well, I do have to say, a public service announcement, it's very difficult to tell where you get food poisoning from.
That's true.
Because it hits you in various amounts of time. So
right.
Everyone out there who writes a Yelp review about getting food poisoning at a restaurant, that's probably not where you got it, just saying.
That's true. It could have been from the botulism I was injecting into his protein smoothie
in the
morning.
Right, to make him Okay, so now we're going to move. We're still in Keith McNally. We're doing, but like the meatpacking district became what it was, what it is now, mm-hmm. in its terrifying currentness. Famously, Samantha moved there in Sex and the City.
Yes.
When it was still part transgender people and also still meatpacking. So right. Keith McNally actually described it in Esquire as, it felt like it was at the world's end. It was raw, natural, alive, a healthy mix of meatpackers and transvestites.
Oh, perfect.
And then they went on in that article, the Esquire article, to just say that Balthazar and Pasties, so Pasties is the restaurant that he opened in the meatpacking district in 1999, which was a very big year for restaurants, and it's still in the 90s, although it's the end of the 90s. And then one of the things that they said, this is kind of like they're looking back at Pasties now, but they're saying a lot of chefs in 2019 may want you or instruct you to gaze in wonder upon the delicate edible origami of their knife work, but Pasties in 1999 wasn't about the chef, it was about you. And so I think that it's interesting because like chefs were important and people knew who they were, but it sort of like was laying the groundwork for like the celebrity chef thing that started happening mostly like in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. It's almost like impossible to like think about a time when they didn't exist in that way.
Yeah.
But this was a time when kind of like it was a little bit different, which I'll go on to reference in my next piece, which is also in 1999, well, technically 1998 on New Year's Eve, Diner opened.
Diner, the best.
And according to Edible Magazine, when he opened Diner, he became the accidental mastermind behind Brooklyn food as you know it.
And he is Andrew Tarlow.
Yes.
Yeah.
He he said in the interview that when he was opening the restaurant for him and Mark Firth, his partner, that they both used to work at the Odeon together.
Tying it all back.
To Keith. The restaurant was like the place and the food was an afterthought. So like essentially like when they brought on Carolyn Vidanza, who's a wonderful, amazing opening chef for that restaurant.
Yay, Karen. She's my food icon here, chef hero.
She's wonderful. She was actually the driving force behind buying from local farmers. That was like sort of her driving idea. And like they weren't the first restaurant to buy local food like from farmers, but they were the first ones to like do it in a non-fine dining way. So it's like accessible and comfortable and like it's a place that you want to hang out. And basically that's kind of all that I have, except for also in 1999 Prune opened. It was like a crazy year for like amazing, interesting restaurants to open that are still around today.
That's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I always sometimes wonder with like Diner and Marlowe, like surely someone might have stepped in and there were other people doing interesting things, but I accidentally said a couple episodes ago, I meant to do a correction about this, but we were talking about Diner and I said fast casual, but I meant to say casual fine dining.
Right.
But I wonder what our restaurant scene would be like today without Diner, because at least by New York standards and metrics, it was the first big thing really in New York to come up that was casual fine dining.
Yeah.
And when you think about where restaurants have gone since then, it's all about casual fine dining.
I mean, it's all that there is, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, not all that there is, but like that's where like 90% of the restaurants in Brooklyn are like. And yeah, the idea that you could still have like elevated, high quality food, but be comfortable and not have to have this like stuffy fine dining experience was like revolutionary.
Totally. I think like in terms of my own cooking career, I've said this before, but I never went to culinary school. I never thought I was gonna be a chef. That wasn't on my radar. I loved to cook, and then I got in an accident, got some money, but like eating at Diner and Marlowe was what inspired me most to want to open my own restaurant and be a chef.
Yeah.
And Carolyn's food especially. I remember she was in my yoga class in like the year 2007, and I was like, oh my God, I was like so starstruck. You would have thought I was like Meryl Streep, like doing a down dog beside me. I've never gotten a chance to tell her that, but if you're listening, which I'm sure you are, Carolyn, big ups. All right, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back, and I have a very intriguing story also about a 1990s restaurant to share with you.
Can't wait.
Okay.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hello, we're back. So usually I start with a joke, but instead of doing a joke today, I'm going to present you with a gift.
Okay.
It's a 1990s gift. It's about what we're talking about last week, so maybe this week I'll present you with like some kind of like spicy tuna roll or something.
Okay, great.
That I have been carrying. Look at this!
Oh my God! These are handy snacks with Ritz crackers. What?
I know, they don't make them with regular crackers anymore.
What the hell?
We've all been eating them.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna eat these.
Yeah. Maybe we should eat. Can you slather us up one?
Yeah.
And we'll try them on the air.
It's a little fun to ASMR. Chew on air, right? Yeah.
Do you know how many calories are in that one packet?
I don't know. 100.
That's it.
Yeah.
You could eat like five of them if you wanted to,
yeah.
Okay, cool. So I'm going to tell the story today.
No,
go ahead, please.
They don't come with the Are they supposed to have a stick?
God damn it. That's the whole thing is the stick. But
I mean,
you know
I
what?
I always avoided using a stick.
Environmentally.
Anyway. Sure.
We don't need to be using a stick. We have 10 sticks attached to our arms.
That is so true.
Just use your thumb. Okay, so I'm going to tell the story of what, in my mind, sticks out to be the most important and influential restaurant of the 1990s. We're about to eat a handy snack. Oh, my God.
The cheese's texture is different.
I like it. It's very salty.
All right.
I think these are from the 90s.
They didn't have the Ritz ones in the 90s.
No, I mean, they just taste so old.
Do you remember they... from 2007.
Oh.
Sure, they also used to have breadstick ones. Right? Mm-hmm. Those are much easier to eat.
I was thinking about which one to get. Yeah. I'm into it. What do you think?
Good.
I'd eat these as a grab and go. That's a good breakfast. 100 calories? Yeah, outdoor?
Put a fried egg on there.
Yeah, you got a stew going. Okay. So, the restaurant that I remember being most important from the 90s, and you mentioned Sex and the City before. It's appeared in there and countless other film and television shows. Mm-hmm. Nobu.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. So, Nobu is a restaurant from a gentleman named Nobu Matsuisa. He was born March 10th, 1949, currently age 70.
Oh, he's and young.
Yeah, he's 70 years young.
The 90s weren't that long ago.
Yeah, true.
It's like the 1960s.
He was born in Japan. When he was 7 years old, unfortunately, his father died in a traffic crash, and he and his two older brothers were raised by his mom. He became a chef in a Tokyo restaurant at 18, and by age 24, 1973, he moves to Lima, Peru, because he's half Peruvian.
Great.
This is where the, you know, I looked a lot about where Asian fusion food was, like, who was accredited to the birth of Asian fusion. A lot of people said it was born in, like, the Philippines. Some people talk about Macau. I was kind of looking for more, like, what chef, you know, made Asian fusion.
Cause who fused it the first?
Who was the first to fuse? I feel like it must have come from all the stuff that he did, but who knows? But he was half Peruvian and half Japanese. So when he moves to Peru, he can't find any Japanese ingredients except for fresh fish. So he starts using Peruvian ingredients. He has olive oil, garlic, chili, cilantro. And he starts doing fusion, but he calls it courageous food.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is...
I mean, that's true. No one else was doing it.
Totally.
Theoretically.
It's absolutely adorable, if nothing else. So he, like, falls out of favor with his business partner at the time. So he goes to Argentina. Argentina's super slow. There's no fresh fish. He's like, I gotta get the hell out of here. Go back to Japan. Please, yes,
so
Nicole.
In Peru, he had opened a restaurant?
He went to go open a restaurant, correct.
Okay.
Exactly. I'm sorry. That's a crucial part of the story. Thank you for keeping me in check. Yes. He goes to open a restaurant. Doesn't work out. His partner's a dick. Or maybe he's the dick. Who's to say?
Nope. We don't know.
Goes back to Japan. Before long, someone gives him an opportunity to open another restaurant. This restaurant is in Alaska. Huh. This is the mid-80s. He takes a $15,000 loan from a friend, goes to Alaska, brings his family. He asks his wife if they can go. He says... he needs to try it one more time. She says, okay, Nobu, no problem. They all go. They open in October. He takes his first day off in November on Thanksgiving Day. The phone rings in the middle of the night. Someone on the other line says, the restaurant is on fire.
What?
So the restaurant burns to the ground within a month of opening.
Was it also
a fusion? It's Japanese, yeah.
Okay.
Fusion restaurant. So he's freaking out. He's quoted as saying, I have no choice now. I have to kill myself. How can I kill myself? Maybe I can get hit by a train, get hit by a car, fall into the ocean. So many different ways.
Could run into a burning restaurant.
Yeah, he could have just gone outside without his socks. It's Alaska. It's freezing. Right. Got eaten by a wolverine. I mean...
I like that falling into the ocean is his, like, suicide.
I know. Thing. I mean, first of all, you're on the shore. You're just going to tip over.
Or maybe he can't swim at all.
Perhaps he doesn't know how to swim. Anyway, I'm glad it didn't happen because he goes to give us so many gifts and, you know, open so many restaurants.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a crazy thing. And in all seriousness, I know that feeling too, in a way of like, sure. You see your whole, all your money, your nest egg, everything, your kids are depending on you, your family.
It's so much like sucks. Emotion and intensity. Like
so much.
Like, yeah, it's crazy.
There was times at Brucey when I felt like, you know, I never, like, planned my suicide, but I definitely was like, don't you laugh at me wanting to commit suicide, well, you bitch.
I'm laughing at that you didn't want to commit suicide.
That's
you didn't
that is funny. I didn't make a plan. anyway, so I definitely had times where I was like, I am so despaired. I want to die because I don't know how to get out of this problem.
Totally.
Okay, so he moves to L.A. His family goes back to Japan for a brief bit. He gets an opportunity in L.A. at a 6-seat restaurant. That he's working for somebody else. His family comes back because
six
it starts
seats.
Six seats.
Wow.
Comes back because it starts working out. He then in 1987 gets a close friend to invest $70,000 to open his own restaurant called Matsuisa. His last name.
Huh.
I knew that. I just didn't know how to pronounce it, and I got really sweaty and nervous for a second. It was in Beverly Hills. Tons of celebrities start coming in. It's in Beverly Hills, as I just mentioned. Sorry, I have Alzheimer's. Robert De Niro comes in one day.
He's everywhere in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly.
He was at Balthazar.
He was at Balthazar, then he gets on a plane and goes over to this place. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he comes in, he loves the food, and he keeps begging Nobu to open a restaurant for like 4 years. Nobu's like, no. And Robert Jr. is like, yeah.
So the place that he got $70,000 for was not
his own place.
But Robert Jr. wants him to open another
place? Another place in New York.
Okay.
Because Robert Jr. is all about that Tribeca lifestyle. Sure is. Right? So anyway, finally he says yes. And in 1994, they opened Nobu in Tribeca. His signature dish, the black cod in miso. Now, black cod is sable. And most people just thought sable is just for, you know, us Jewish folks. But really, it's for everyone, including the Japanese. So the black cod and miso, I was just talking to Michael out there who does the food scene before us. And he was talking about how the black cod and miso is equal parts miso, soy, and sweet miso, mirin, and sweet soy. I don't even know. I don't know what the hell is in it. Who knows? Nobody knows for sure.
No one knows.
Everyone knows that has access to the internet.
Industry secret.
Anyway, it was very popular and became like replicated. And he started doing a lot of this like fusion stuff. He would have different types of ingredients and nobody was aware of that. Actually, Ruth Reichel goes on to say later in this that nobody until 1995 in New York, she still had to describe to people in the Times what sushi was.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. People had no idea. So anyway, Nobu attributes his success to learning from failure after failure, which I love because that's exactly what we talk about on the show, and I actually feel very similar. And he says his secret to success is, quote, kokoro. Kokoro in English means your heart.
Aww.
Which is so cute. He had small roles in 3 major films, including Casino, alongside his business partner Robert De Niro, Austin Powers in 2002, and Memoirs of a Geisha. They now have, I believe, 42 restaurants and a bunch of luxury hotels. I think 8 luxury hotels. The international brand, Nobu Hospitality, is worth $500 million, obviously. His business partner is Robert De Niro, and he has a couple other people. It's pretty insane. Like, what they're planning on doing, they're just keep rolling them out. They're restaurants all over the world. Ruth Reichel quoted as saying when she first ate at Nobu, "I was a real sushi aficionado, very much into classical sushi, so I was a little taken aback. It seemed tricky to me. The menu was pages and pages long, but I was also intrigued by the things he was doing, like the squid he turned into pasta. I was gradually won over."
So he did squidding pasta? Is that what?
I think he turned actual squid into pasta.
Whoa, yeah. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. And then she says, "It's difficult to understand from this vantage point, but as late as 1995, I still had to explain what sushi was to the readers in the New York Times. There's not a big sushi aesthetic in New York, not like in Los Angeles."
Interesting. So it was already a thing in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And then in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. I think there was more Japanese immigrants in Los Angeles. Actually, we did the history of the California roll.
That makes sense.
There was a lot of Japanese folks in Canada and then also on the West Coast because it's a bit closer.
I think it's so fascinating because there was a sushi restaurant in Indianapolis in the 90s. I just don't understand. Was it
amazing?
It was fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't. I like didn't eat sushi until I was like 20 or something.
Was it all lake trout?
No. It's like regular. My sister actually worked there. I think I mentioned that either on this podcast or another podcast that we were on together.
Oh, amazing.
But it's just weird that the Indiana caught on to sushi so early. I don't know.
Early adapters. Yeah. Well, you know what Mike Pence always says, a sushi roll a day keeps all the gay people away from me. All right, listen. So, what restaurant... Okay, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. A little surprise chef recommends. What restaurant would you go to now if you most wanted to channel 90s vibes?
I mean, I don't know. So, interestingly, I was doing this research and I kept being like, oh, all those vegetarian restaurants in the East Village are from the 90s, but they're all from the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
So I think, but they remind me of the 90s so much. Like,
totally.
Like Angelica Kitchen, like, they're also like clothes, but like Angelica Kitchen to me is like 90s, like Dragon Bowl, like totally. Birkenstocks and socks and like hippie vibe kind of thing.
Like the NoHo Star. Is that place still open? That's on Lafayette? That was very 90s to me.
I don't know, actually. Yeah. Have you ever been to Nobu?
I've never been to Nobu. Hmm. Or Nobu Next Door, which they opened as like the cheaper version, which is still extremely expensive.
It's very expensive, yeah.
No, I've never been to Nobu. I've never been to the Odeon. I have been to Balthazar. I will say that Balthazar, I think, is where I would say I'd go.
Oh, yeah.
Or Outback Steakhouse.
Oh, it's chain restaurants.
Yeah.
Well, then I would go to Chi Chi's, which is a now closed chain restaurant from the Midwest.
We didn't have Chi Chi's. Was that the same as Cece's? Isn't that a pizza place?
Cece's is like a pizza buffet
thing. What's Chi Chi's?
It's like a not great Mexican restaurant chain that also Chi Chi's means like boobs in Spanish.
Interesting. They're actually also a sponsor of today's show, brought to you by boobs. Excuse me, I'm battling a cold. I would go to, I mean, Balthazar is amazing. I've only been for drinks there, but it's very fun because they give you free nibbles and amazing. They'll bring out a whole freaking tier of hard-boiled eggs.
Also, there's like a crazy pastry basket that you can get during brunch that's like basically probably as high as the seafood tower. It's like 7,000 pastries.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, their pastries are good. I love their scones, which you can find basically everywhere.
Yeah.
Although, okay, so they have their scones at Bittersweet Coffee, which is my favorite and least favorite coffee spot ever in Fort Greene. They have great coffee. They have La Colombe. They have Balthazar pastries. But there's a lot of problems. Like, they only open one of the doors. It's set up strange. But I go there all the time religiously.
You do, yeah.
I love it there.
But wait, I was thinking the one other thing about Balthazar we have to talk about is when the mirror fell off.
Oh, my God, the mirror! That's crazy.
I know.
It was like a 2,000-pound mirror, and it just fell right off the wall into a bunch of people. Nobody died.
Nobody died or was severely injured. But can you imagine?
No. Actually, I can't. Although I can imagine anything. There was a time, I don't know if you were there, but at Brucey when the wall lit on fire. No, it was not just there. Next to some diners for no reason. It just lit on fire. Okay, cool. What are your three favorite dishes from the 1990s style dishes?
So mine is just going to be like stuff that I was eating in the 90s. Please. I don't obviously think it was invented in the 90s, but
yeah.
Here we go. So I was definitely eating Bagel Bites. I'm sorry to be in the back, but they were just very important to my life.
They're great.
Also, in the 90s, my dad worked for... My dad's a mechanic for semi, so he worked on McDonald's semi trucks.
Uh-huh.
So he would get bulk McDonald's food frozen, and we would eat that.
Like, oh, my God.
And it tasted very different than it did at the restaurant. Because,
how so?
Well, we would bake the fries instead of frying them, and, like, there would be, like... I don't know. It's just like the way that we prepared them was just different, but it was just fascinating to me that we had warehouse McDonald's food in our house.
It's amazing.
We had the chicken breast, like with the grill marks already on it.
Really?
Yeah.
Better or worse at home?
It was worse at home.
Perfect.
yeah. And then I think basically casseroles were an important part of my childhood. I was, you know, in high school, middle school, high school in the 90s. So the tuna casserole with the potato chips on top.
Sure.
I was eating that.
Potato chips or potato sticks?
Chips.
Okay, because potato sticks were also a popular casserole topper.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
That's right. And cornflakes.
That's right.
That's right. All right, I'm going to go ahead and say, I have a couple. Sizzling fajitas.
Okay, great. I never wanted this, but I do remember very strongly you're eating in a restaurant and they just walk by you and it's sizzling so loud.
So loud. Stops everyone's conversation. Every 2 seconds you have to stop your conversation. You're like, Mom, you're like, kids, Mom and Dad are going to get a...
Yes.
You're like, excuse me, come again.
It's comically loud. They're like carrying burning hot fire at this restaurant. Those poor servers.
I know. Sizzling fajitas were absolutely amazing, though. I really, really liked them.
so funny to me. I don't know.
I'm going to drop another thing on you. No idea whether this was 90s or not, but I definitely ate in stuffed crust pizza.
Oh, my God. Yes, definitely. Because I worked at Pizza Hut. So it was definitely the 90s because I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Huge game changer.
Yeah. Really? Total game changer.
Yeah.
And then another thing that was definitely inspired by Nobu, but I remember having it at Sushi Samba, which is another restaurant from the 90s that is so worth mentioning.
Yes.
Do you remember Sex in the City? It was like Sushi Samba is the coolest place ever. And I remember going to FIT. This almost makes me cry. And I like brought my parents there. Aww. And they thought it was like so fun. We're like, this is the greatest place ever. And it was the greatest place ever. It was so fun. Like, it was this kind of like almost theme restaurant for like adults, and I had never experienced that before.
Yeah, that sounds... I never went there, but it sounds incredible.
Like, just like poor quality fish drenched in lots of sauces, very expensive flourless chocolate cake oozing by the gallon.
90s classic.
Yeah, lots of I remember we would go, oh, you know what, I was going to say my favorite thing was a sushi taco, which was something that Nobu championed, but I'm switching to a beverage, which was also not invented in the 90s, but definitely popularized in the 90s. Can you guess what it is?
No.
The Cosmopolitan.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I loved it. Popular. People order that all the time at the restaurant that I work at.
Really? Yeah. Do you guys have cranberry juice?
We do not. You can't get it there.
What do you mean? You just say no?
I'm like, please, no. You cannot have this.
What do you give them instead? A shot of Jameson?
I'm like, yes. We don't have Jameson.
That's what I used to do when I was bartending. People would come in and be like, can I get a slippery vagina or like a hairy eyeball? I'd be like, sure. And then, you know, whatever weird shot the kids were drinking at the time, and I'd be like, yep, here you go. And I'd just pour straight Jameson. They'd be like, wait, I asked for a squirrely backbone. And I'm like, yeah, this is it. This is how we make it here. Just Jameson.
Squirrely backbone. You've just been waiting to rattle off these fake cocktail names.
Can I get a turtle shell dripped in nacho cheese? Mm-hmm. It's made of pure Jameson. No problem.
That does remind me, though, of... So, I was in college at the very end of the 90s, but I was just talking about this, about how I was really into drinking, like, the ultra-light beers for, like, like Michelob Ultra.
Sure.
And then also flavored vodka was happening. Mm. And I would drink vanilla vodka and Diet Cokes.
Oh, yeah. I have a horrible thing to mention from the 90s. How about, ever heard of Bud Ice?
I have heard of it. Is it, what it, is
it's
it?
It's like extra strong Budweiser that makes 16-year-olds who drink it puke all over
it's like
Sweet 16.
Steel Reserve is like that.
Yeah. I remember my first drinking experience. Well, that's not true. I think my first drinking experience, I was like 9. I started early. But when I was, my first like getting very sick experience, I was taking shots of Beefeater gin, Jesus, as one does when they're 15 or 16.
Nope, Goldschlager over here.
And I was chasing it with Bud Ice, and we went to a friend's Sweet 16, and I vomited on the dance floor all over her family, but nobody noticed because I was a sneaky puker because I was embarrassed, but I did
all
have to puke.
All over her family?
I puked all over the dance floor, and her family,
was
I remember,
dancing
was
in
dancing in it.
That is so disgusting.
Can you imagine? You have a child, you do your best, and it's dumbass friend. I wasn't even actually really very good friends with this person. I barely
it's
knew
friend.
Them. It's friend. It's acquaintance comes to your party that you spend your hard-earned money for, and
you roll
barfs
the dice.
Everywhere.
You roll it. If a teenager sucks, like you just they
stink.
Yeah,
I also barfed in washing machines, down my own shirt,
in
my friends' cars. I was a big puker in the 90s and 2000s.
Yeah,
today
yeah,
not
yeah.
so much.
Yeah, that's interesting. Also, I was speaking of drinking when you're 9. One of the beer rips. I was telling them about this podcast and about we were talking about hard seltzer. Of course, everyone can't stop talking about it, and then we circled back to Mike's Hard Lemonade, and he was like,
very 90s.
He was like, the first time I ever had alcohol was by accident because my mom had Mike's Hard Lemonade in the refrigerator, and I'm like literally 9, and I'm like coming home from school, and I'm just like, oh, cool, lemonade. And so my mom comes home from work, and I'm just sitting there doing my homework, drinking a Mike's Hard Lemonade, and she was like, what the hell are you doing? And he's like, what? And she, like, he had no idea.
That's really funny. Mike's Hard Lemonade was definitely a 90s, 2000s thing, but it gave me terrible diarrhea. Like, I remember being at parties and, like, having to, like, have diarrhea because I had drank, like, 5 Mike's Hard Lemonades and just being like, what am I doing to my, what am I doing with my life? Anyway.
Which is a question everyone asks themselves when they're young, and then they just stop doing it later.
Exactly. That's why I'm now a representative for Mike. This show brought to you by Mike's Hard Lemonade and also by Pepto-Bismol.
And Chi-Chi's.
And Chi-Chi's. All right, guys. Nicole, this was just lovely. I can't wait. Join us next week for part 3.
Okay, great.
We're going to be, what are we going to talk about? Movies.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
This is a food
I'm
podcast.
Not even going to be here. I quit. Hasta la pasta. Life's Banquet is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Or connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.